We have a rather hybrid situation this morning where we have an appellant who becomes the respondent and vice versa. You have 60 minutes between the two arguments, obviously. We preliminarily decided there's no need for you to close out one argument and change tables and do all of that. And in fact, the three of us are quite happy if you want to just divide your time in an equal amount of time, 30 minutes on one side, 30 minutes on the other. You can put this before the court in any way that you feel is best and most appropriate for your positions. We will, of course, start with the appellant on the lower case captioned case, which is the direct appeal case. It is 65510. So we'll start there. If you want a moment to consider how you want to present it, we'll certainly be willing to give you that moment. Otherwise, you can just do 30-30. It's up to you.
And each side can reserve.
I'm sorry?
Each side can reserve.
Oh, of course, yeah. And each side can reserve a rebuttal time, however you want to do it, however you choose to do it.
Yes, Your Honor, I'm going to show you for petitioners in the last case. I think we refer to previous as two half-hour arguments. First, from your counsel. Second,
So do I hear you correctly? Two completely separate cases as if they were not related, if you will. Is that what I'm hearing you say you want? Counsel? Very well. We'll proceed. We'll call the first case then, which is 65. Actually, on the calendar, it is 66569, Michalkowski versus District Court. That's the first case up.
Good morning, Your Honor.
Good morning, Your Honor. Kenneth Chang.
Good morning.
May it please the court. Looking at the trial court's decision here, which is a one-sentence decision granting the motion to compel arbitration, it's hard to know exactly where to start in terms of findings of facts, rulings of law. But it seems to me we ought to start with the easiest situations. And that is, for example, for two of the homes in this 27-home case, Lennar did not produce any sales contract at all. So there was no document by the party asserting arbitration on which to base a claim for arbitration. There was no contract produced, period. No contract means no enforceable agreement to arbitrate. The second easiest situation, I believe, deals with subsequent buyers, those homeowners who did not sign any contract with Lennar. Those homeowners who later bought their homes from the original owners or the second owner or the third owner or the fourth owner, they signed no agreement with Lennar. The subsequent buyers did not have any, obviously, any opportunity to negotiate the terms of any arbitration. They did not have the those terms presented to them in any fashion. And there is no case, and I'm sure if Lennar's counsel could have found a case in the United States where the subsequent buyer is bound by the terms of an original buyer, including an arbitration term, we would have seen it in one of the briefs. So in terms of the two homes with no agreement, that's easy. In terms of the subsequent owners who did not sign any agreement, including these four arbitration agreements, I think it's equally easy. Now, I know there's an argument on the other side that the first two versions of the...
Before you get there, the really fundamental out of the chute question is whether or not extraordinary writ relief is appropriate. And I understand that our Uniform Arbitration Act only gives a direct right of appeal where arbitration has been denied on a motion to compel. And some of our cases say, well, that means that you must run a writ in order to get interlocutory review of it. But it raises a question in my mind, does that just dispense with the ordinary writ requirements, or are you still obligated to make some showing that the eventual appeal from an order either confirming or denying the arbitration award is not adequate? And if so, why not? What about this case qualifies for extraordinary writ relief? A and B, let me finish my question. Does not the UAA express a substantive legal judgment, policy judgment, that we're going to allow, because we favor enforcement of arbitration agreements, an immediate interlocutory appeal of an order denying arbitration, but we are withholding that right statutorily in the case of an order compelling arbitration, and that in turn expresses the policy favoring arbitration. There are cases out there elsewhere under the Uniform Act like that. And when I read these briefs, it gave me real pause. We're all just assuming mandamus.
Yes, Your Honor. I think whether it's an assumption or relying upon, I forget, one of the three main cases, Birch, Green, or Gonski, came up by way of a writ petition. And they
Gonski, you're correct.
Gonski. And that basically says this is an appropriate topic for writ consideration. And so we followed that procedure.
Yeah, I think that's fair in this case. I'm more exploring the law as it should be, and I don't think you should be disadvantaged because we haven't.
Right. The only comment from the NAR briefs on that topic was that we have an adequate remedy by way of appeal after either
at the end of the day.
At the end of the case. And yet the arbitration agreements that they seek to enforce call for binding arbitration, no appeal. Now, with the exception of version 3, which calls for a judicial reference procedure before arbitration, with a judicial reference allowing an appeal, specifically in the sale contract, doesn't allow an appeal from a decision by a judge under judicial reference. With that exception, the arbitration provisions all say they are binding. There is no appeal. So to say that we have an adequate remedy by way of appeal afterwards, when their agreement eliminates that, is
but if you were remitted to arbitration, say, in the other case, you would certainly assert that you do have a right of judicial review of the end result, regardless of whatever the ARB says, because the statute gives you that right. Or not?
I don't think it's a realistic right, because the question of a binding arbitration becomes everything is in favor of that arbitration, everything conceivable. From
and it's deferential review by us, I mean, at that point, yeah.
And so I don't believe that's a sort of fair playing field, if you will.
Okay. I didn't mean to take you off your discussion of the four contracts and the buyers you represent. I'm sorry, I was just curious about the mandamus.
I understand.
Mr. Chairman, which of the two homeowners are the ones that there were no contracts on?
I believe it's Andrada, A-N-D-R-A-D-A. And Schwitters, S-C-H-W-I-T-T-E-R-S.
Okay.
I believe there was no contract whatsoever. Mm-hmm. In terms of the subsequent homeowners, the only argument that we've heard from the NAR side is that those subsequent owners are third-party beneficiaries, intended to be third-party beneficiaries of this contract, and second, that there's a provision that the first buyer is to pass on to buyer two, or whoever buys from them, these same terms and agreements. That's the intended beneficiary of the language is particularly inappropriate for versions 1 and 2, because in version 1, paragraph 16.16, there is a paragraph that says no other person is intended to be a beneficiary of this contract, 16.16 in version 1. So it's intended just to be limited to the parties. Well, that seems to contradict their argument that actually later buyers are intended to be the third-party beneficiaries. That same paragraph appears in version 2, paragraph 17.16. So for the first two versions of the arbitration agreement, the agreement itself contradicts the idea that there is some other person, some third party, some later buyer who is intended to be bound by the terms of this agreement.
What are the client's claims that you're representing? Aren't they all premised on these sale contracts?
They're not premised on the failed purchase contract. They're premised on Chapter 40, which says if a house has construction defects, homeowners should not come out of pocket to get them fixed. They should be able to make a claim to either get them fixed by the developer or to recover money so that net they have enough to fix the home. That's the premise of the claim. It's not based on a purchase agreement. And this sort of ties in with the argument about whether the Federal Arbitration Act applies or not. In our point of view, it does not, because the actual construction that occurs is what the claim is. The windows are flashed wrong. All that occurred in Nevada. The roofs were installed improperly. All that occurred in Nevada. The soils were compacted improperly. All that occurs in Nevada. That's not an interstate commerce point.
That's
not an interstate commerce activity. But in the bigger picture, It does not matter whether the FAA applies or Nevada's policy in favor of arbitration applies. Both those policies apply. If the agreements can be substantively unconscionable and procedurally are conscionable, if it's agreement. So it doesn't really matter whether the FAA applies or not, because it's the standard of unconscionability is still what has to be met. In terms of
on the unconscionability issue, does it matter that there's a severance clause in here? Compared to our previous cases, which you referred to.
You know, it's tempting to say there's a severance, and let's just take out maybe the worst parts of each of these agreements. Let's take version one, paragraph 7.4, says the homeowners waive all Chapter 40 rights and damages. Well, that's pretty strong. And essentially, Lennar in previous cases in this one says, okay, just strike that one out so it doesn't contradict Gonski, the basic public policy. But then it becomes, how much farther do you go? Because 7.4 is the waiver of Chapter 40, but 7.3 says fees and costs.
Which agreement are you under? The
version 1. Excuse me. Version 1.
Okay, so
version 1. The next paragraph, or the paragraph below 7.4, 7.3 says fees and costs will be awarded to a party that is attempting to enforce the arbitration agreement. It's a one-sided fees and cost provision in favor of Lennar in case there's a question about whether this agreement should be enforced.
I think your opponent concedes that that would need to be stricken, correct?
Okay, now we have...
Or not.
I think the language in their brief isn't specific about which parts should be stricken.
I noticed that too.
So we kind of go, how many more provisions do we have to strike to make it not one-sided? Well, there's the one-sided provision that Lennar alone has the choice of whether to add subcontractors, that is, the people who actually did the work would be the target. That's one side. There's the provision that if home builder's warranty provisions are involved, you might go by the HBW procedures or by the arbitration procedures or by something else if it's a mixture. So there are kind of one-sided provision after one-sided provision in the agreement, and the question becomes, how many of those do you have to strike to make it fair? The only thing I would add on that topic is that some courts, in order to enforce arbitration agreements, have gone the other direction and said, we'll enforce this if we construe it to include all statutory rights. That's Kindred versus District Court here in Nevada. It was an employee who had sued for harassment and employment discrimination under a contract and under the Family Leave Act. And the way the court could construe that arbitration as including both types of claims is to say that all statutory rights are preserved. So if we're trying to save this unconscionable agreement by striking out various sections.
Can you do that with the interaction of Chapter 40 and how it affects the process?
The only, simpler is better, and I think the only way to approach it is to say, if this arbitration is to be a truly neutral arbitration forum agreement, then just all Chapter 40 rights and remedies apply, but go to a neutral forum, go to arbitration forum.
Yikes, yeah. That's a pretty big shift.
Well, that's in the Cole versus Burns case. That's in the Kindred case here in Nevada. It's a way to save the agreement. I don't prefer it because I think there are too many complications and negative aspects in these agreements. Page after page of limited warranties and exceptions and redefining qualifying defects and all that sort of thing. But if we're in the rewriting business, we're kind of opening up the door to that. I would reserve the balance of my time.
Thank you.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Justice Seda, and Justices, Robert Schumacher for Lennar Reno LLC, respondent with me as name.
What about the two homeowners that, or two plaintiffs for whom there is no contract in this record, even arguably?
Justice Pickering, Lennar would concede that without contracts, it's difficult to imagine the district court rendering a finding that those non-existent agreements could be compelled, those plaintiffs could be compelled to arbitration.
So do you concede that Andrade and I wrote down Schwitters?
Yes, but we do.
That they are entitled to litigate?
Yes.
Okay.
We do. Lenar does concede that. The absence of any specific findings by the district court, though, is not fatal. As the court is aware, it is entitled to infer findings. And the district court order compelling arbitration should be affirmed because Lenar's arbitration agreements are legally enforceable, and the record at the district court level does indeed support that finding.
As to the 25 remaining?
Well.
Or what about the other two?
There is another category, Justice Pickering, that was brought up, and that is, what about the subsequent homeowners? Lenar acknowledges that as a subsequent homeowner, it's difficult to find a legal basis or infer a finding at the district court level that would allow Lenar to compel them to arbitration. However, the record also indicates that those same subsequent purchasers filed a complaint based on the contract, the very contract that they now attempt to disavow. And the case law is replete that where...
That's an estoppel case argument.
Indeed.
So you take issue of what Mr. Shinnick said, that they're suing under Chapter 40 remedies and not under the contract.
I do, and I would ask the court to look at the record. The complaint indicates that those same plaintiffs, the subsequent purchasers, are suing on the contract. There is a breach of contract cause of action. There is a breach of third-party beneficiary, and I believe one other cause of action specifically based on the contract. And the case law in Nevada is clear. If a party litigant is going to avail themselves of the benefits of a contract, they cannot at the same time disavow the less fortunate or less favorable aspects of that contract. But let me digress. The court brought up a question that we struggled with in writing the brief, and that is, do the normal requirements of a writ of mandamus apply in the arbitration context, in the context of this case? And we struggled with it, candidly. But the answer to Justice Pickering's question is, yes, this court should apply the same criteria that it has been applying and ask the question, is the petitioner entitled to extraordinary relief? And the answer is no in this case. Arbitration was compelled by the district court. The record supports that finding. And there is an adequate remedy at law. They can file an appeal at the end if they're unsatisfied with the arbitrator's decision. And they can go back to square one. The appellate court, if they agree with the petitioner, would then strike the arbitration order or the order compelling arbitration, and they would be in state court.
Well, they might be happy at the end of the arbitration, too. I mean,
of course.
And plus, the ability to challenge an arbitration is pretty limited under Nevada law. So I don't know how much of a remedy it is at that stage.
Well, Justice Gibbons, the NRS 38 does indeed entitle the party seeking to enforce an arbitration award several options. One is to file a motion either to affirm it if they like it, but they also can go to the other extreme and seek to set it aside.
The ability to set it aside is almost non-existent under our case law, you know, like that. I mean, we're just dealing with the issue, should we entertain the writ? I mean, do they have any remedy here or not? That's my question. I mean, it's not like a court proceeding where you have, a standard review. It's something a little bit easier to argue as far as an appeal. Mm-hmm.
The Lenar agreements are silent as to the appealability of the arbitration award. They do indicate that they're
fine. Let me pause you there, though. If there was an order that was entered compelling arbitration, it's not directly appealable under the ARB Act, so they're running a writ, and the argument is that is the eventual appeal of that is not adequate. But the review would not be deferential as to the legal propriety of ordering arbitration at that point, would it? Because it's a question of law, unless you have a delegation clause, which nobody's arguing here. It's a question of law whether or not there was an arbitration agreement that merited sending this case to arbitration. So at the end of the arbitration proceeding, in answer to Justice Gibbons' point, you would have plenary review or complete review of the question of arbitrability, would you not, rather than deferential review, because that issue would not have been committed to the arbitrator in the first instance.
It would be a de novo review.
Yeah.
Okay, thank you.
I don't mean to answer your questions, but I'm thinking out loud here on it.
The district court's order is consistent with the resolute Nevada public policy of supporting arbitrations. The district court sought to enforce the arbitration provision consistent with every other, as it was in every other contract case. The distinction, though, that Lennar draws and would like to focus the court on is that the Lennar agreements differ substantially in key material aspects.
Which provisions do you concede are unconscionable and should be stricken? Your opposing colleague was struggling to identify them, and I am too, I must confess. There are some that you seem to agree need to be taken out.
Indeed we do, Your Honor. These agreements, most of them were drafted prior to the court's holding in the Gonski case.
Right.
And we now know that it is contrary to public policy for these types of agreements to purport to limit or circumscribe in any way a home buyer's right to the so-called Chapter 40 entitlements. And so obviously it follows that the version 1 of the purchase agreement has in it a provision that purports to abrogate entirely the remedies of Chapter 40. Lennar concedes and conceded in its brief that that should be stricken. Justice Gibbons asked about the severability provision in all of these contracts. And in Nevada, the courts look at the plain meaning of the contract language. It's clear that the contracting parties, Lennar and the home buyers, intended by their unambiguous language to, in this contingency, strike the offensive or the language that was contrary to public policy. I think we all concede that a provision that purports to abrogate a home buyer's right to the so-called Chapter 40 entitlements should be stricken.
What about attorney's fees and costs?
Attorney's fees and costs, none of the agreements, with the exception of this version, which is, I believe, four homes, purports to abrogate or limit in any way the Chapter 40 rights.
Okay, including the right for them to recover fees.
Precisely.
Okay.
And so, and that's really the key distinction. The Gonski, the Birch, and the D.R. Horton versus Green case really, in my mind, focused on the fact that those agreements did not draw attention to the home buyer, to the fact that they were giving up valuable state rights, in this instance, Chapter 40. The Lennar agreements specifically state that they are waiving important rights, that they should seek advice of counsel. Unlike the other cases where 470 pages of documents in one instance are piled in front of the home buyer, take it or leave it, sign it, initial it, and put it in that box because we have more people to sell homes to. That was not the case with Lennar. Each representative.
So are you backing up on your concession that the waiver of the Chapter 40 rights is invalid and should be stricken?
No.
But you're saying that it might be defensible because your contract was different?
No, we are saying, Lennar concedes that where the agreements purport to limit or abrogate the Chapter 40 entitlements, that they should be stricken.
Okay, okay.
All of the other agreements that are at issue in this case do not do so. The Lennar agreement really is a forum-shifting provision. All of the rights and remedies, the substantive law, the damages that otherwise could be obtained, assuming plaintiff meets their burden, can be recovered whether it's in arbitration or state court. And that's a key distinction between this case, the Lennar agreements, and the Gonski, Birch, and the other case.
Green is pretty important to me. I was there. And this court, when I was not a member of it, did a pretty thorough analysis of the agreements after the district court's decision was before it. And I'm just wondering how you can make such a broad brush statement that because they are not the exact same type of agreement that were before the home buyer in the other three cases, that they still don't rise to the level of unconscionability in some way. You're telling these people who are sitting across from you, as you pointed out yourself, with a stack of papers saying, here, sign these or move out of the way. There's more coming in behind you. Is that really fair, as the way we look at these agreements?
Justice Sotomayor welcomes the opportunity to distinguish the Green case, facts and circumstances that existed then, the agreement in that case, with the current situation. The longest of the four types of agreement that Lennar put before the home buyer was 15 pages.
Okay, well, length wasn't the only issue here. I mean, in any of those cases.
Agreed. One issue in Green that the court, that this court found repugnant was the fact that the language purporting to waive the home buyer's rights under state law was in very small font, and it was on the back of the page. An even smaller font. The Lennar agreements, boom, they flash out, bold, capitalized. You are waiving important legal rights. Go get a lawyer. That was not the situation in the Green case, respectfully. And I think most importantly in the Green case, the D.R. Horton representative misled in a way the home buyer, indicating that don't worry about the stuff on the back of the page. It's standard contract language. The Lennar representative did the opposite, walked them through each page. Once the home buyer was finished, they initialed, signifying that they had read and understood, or at least had no questions with the language. In some instances, they actually initialed right under the arbitration provision, signifying that they had specifically read that. So there are important distinctions. I think it's quite easy, frankly, for Lennar to distinguish its agreement and the facts and circumstances surrounding these four versions of its agreement with the Gonski, Birch, and D.R. Horton case. Those are extreme examples that, frankly, factually differ in material ways to the facts and circumstances in this instance.
Well, you've told us typeface and length. What else differentiates those decisions?
From Lennar's perspective, Justice Pickering, the key consideration was notice to the homebuyer. Were they given fair notice that they were, by signing this agreement, agreeing to buy the home, waiving important legal rights, the right to recover damages for construction defect, in this context, under Chapter 40? And I remind the court that nothing save the repugnant version that predated Gonski, nothing in those agreements purports to limit in any way or abrogate the home buyer's right to seek every remedy they otherwise would be entitled to in state court under Chapter 40.
Except a full and outright waiver.
Except for the one version which we've addressed, and we would ask the court to apply the severability provision in the contract consistent with the party's intent, which is manifested unequivocally and unambiguously.
And that contract has a severability clause in it, that version of your contract?
Yes, they all do.
Yeah, okay.
The other distinction, Justice Seda, is this. In two of the other cases cited by petitioner, the contract was basically placed in front of the home buyer. Take it or leave it. We have other people in line that would love to buy your home. That was not the circumstance with Lennar. There are instances where the agreements were negotiated, suggesting that, in fact, there was a discourse. It was not a take it and leave it. Thank you.
I have one more question. Did you argue in the district court that unconscionability should, of the agreement as a whole, should be decided by the district, by the arbitrator at all? Did you make any argument at all that any of these issues were committed to the arbitrator?
In the two cases at issue.
In this case, yeah. Okay. Thank you. So that issue just was not argued. It was waived.
Excuse me?
That issue was simply not argued by Lennar in either of these two matters before this court today.
Right.
Okay. Thank you.
Mr. Shinnick.
Touching on each of the points, or some of the points mentioned here, in terms of the third-party beneficiary cause of action, that's mainly based on the construction contract between the developer and the subs, where the contract says, build the house per the code. We believe homeowners are third-party beneficiaries of that contract. There is language in that cause of action dealing with the purchase, but it's not being sued on that basis. And in other cases, in other of the, say, 10 or 12 Lennar cases that we've argued on arbitration, we have agreed to withdraw that cause of action. In terms of whether the writ petition or appeal at the end of the process is an adequate remedy, it's particularly inadequate in this case. Even up to today, almost half of these homeowners have sold their homes in each of the cases before the court this morning. So in terms of an adequate remedy...
Well, how do we know that?
That is not in the record, but it is a fact that... That is, it will tie into our argument in the second case about the prejudice to the plaintiffs.
Right. I know you've got some generic ones that are subsequent buyers, right. But the right. Statement you just made is not in the record. We can't really deal with that.
In the second case. In terms of the other parts of these versions that you would have to, might want to strike in order to make them conscionable, here are some more examples. Go to version 2. Paragraph 7.5 says, a non-contesting party on the arbitration shall be awarded legal fees and expert and expenses, including appellate proceedings. In other words, if you rule in Lennar's favor today, or on this case, their first thing is a claim for legal fees against the homeowners for contesting these arbitration. That's a one-sided agreement, much like the Green case had the $10,000 liquidated damages clause in that arbitration agreement. A no-contest poison pill type claim. That's in versions 2 and 4 of the arbitration agreements. In addition to the overall language in version 1 about Chapter 40 rights being waived, version 4 in 16.6 says all parties are to bear their own fees. 16.8 says arbitration fees are to be shared, and the mediation fees are to be shared equally. So there's a whole slew of miscellaneous costs and fees provisions throughout these multiple paragraphs, multiple subparagraphs, all designed with one thing, to eliminate homeowner rights. That's basically our overall argument. These agreements are agreements that strip homeowners of their Chapter 40 rights disguised as arbitration agreements. That's what they are. The overall impact of this was not to just do like the AT&T conception case, like the Kindred case, was not just to find a neutral forum, an arbitration rather than a court system or a jury trial. It was to take out the rights and then also go to a separate arbitration. And that's why you go one by one through each of these. It's like their best imagination.
If I ask Mr. Shinnick one more question. You mentioned about the status of the complaint and these causes of action regarding breach of contract in Chapter 40. What's the current status? I mean, have you amended the complaint to drop any type of breach of contract claims?
No, Your Honor. The case has been stayed since the notice of appeal.
Okay. But what's the status of the current pending complaint? What does that allege?
It's stayed. Nothing has happened since the motion to compel arbitration.
So it still contains the contract claims, et cetera?
It does. No okay. Changes have been made.
Right.
I know I'm beyond the time. If I could use maybe 2 minutes for my next argument, the next case.
You'll be taking the wisdom of the approach suggested by Justice Sada.
I only want to say version 3 is also unique, different from the others, because it's not an arbitration agreement. What is it? It's an agreement In paragraph 4, it says arbitration for buyer's default, that is, on the sale. The sale didn't happen. Paragraph 21 is judicial reference for construction defects, specific to construction defects. And this judicial reference paragraph, somewhere in Lenar, they decided to be fair in this because they said all available remedies would be available under the judicial reference. They said the buyers are not required to pay any fees of judicial reference. They said it does not limit any valid cause of action. So that was actually a reasonable terms, much like the AT&T conception case and other types of cases. Later on in that agreement 3, it says if reference is not available, then you go to these various arbitration terms that have the same unconscionable terms about not defining what a defect is, not allowing recoveries of costs, on and on and on. But their first motivation, but only four people signed this one, is for judicial reference. And it's not even a agreement to compel arbitration. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Schenck. We have given you an extra 2.25 minutes. We'll limit it to two, so we'll only take two off of the next argument. And